Blog Talk Radio.
Seniors for Peace, a celebration of 20 years of peace work.
We have our drummers out. We'll be singing protest songs when the drummers get tired. But the drummers seem to have a lot of energy and go on for a long time.
They rally for peace every Friday at 4 p.m., rain or shine, with banners, hand drums, guitar, and fiddle. On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. The Missouri Radio Free Kansas.
Boy, I'll tell you, that's Mariah Gillardin's show, TUC Radio, which will be in the second hour after our headline lineup and Alex Smith's EcoShock Radio. But, you know, it's just a hint. I hear that about 20 years working for peace. During the Gulf War, the Gulf Wars, Gulf War One and Gulf War Two, there was a group of people in Kansas City who did the same thing. They held a vigil for months, years, literally, and they would assemble different places, but mainly down around the plaza in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. And I always thought of that. I didn't go, but to a few of their vigils, 60 miles away. But I would go there to check in to see who was there, and it was always inspiring to see these people. That was in the early, mid-90s, well, throughout the 90s. Endless war, correct? I mean, you know, this is going way back. So it's always inspiring to hear these stories of dedicated people for peace. It's gone on a long time. I have, in 1985, I believe it was, 86, I was writing as a correspondent to a newspaper, and I wrote several stories about the, what do they call themselves, the silo plowshares, I think they were called. They would go to the missile lids, the nuclear ICBM missiles, controlled here in the Midwest by NORAD, to launch and essentially obliterate Russia and, as a consequence, the world, really. And I would go up there, and they would take jackhammers to the lids, the concrete lids of these missile silos. And I couldn't get very close because they would trespass, cross the cut holes in the fences or climb the fences surrounding these missile lids, because they're scattered, at least then in the mid-80s and late-80s. They were scattered throughout, they still are, throughout the Midwest, strange places out in Iowa, Nebraska, here in Kansas. There's missiles buried in the ground in these huge underground silos. Now, many of them have since been obsoleted and taken out, and rich people move into them for their bug out luxury. Well, they're not all luxury, but people have moved into them now in some places. But these peace people would go out there, largely religious pacifists. And they would take and rent these jackhammers and all kinds of stuff. They'd do different things, the different missile lids. And they'd go out there and commit acts of vandalism on the missile lids. And inevitably, somebody, the county sheriff and the deputies or the Air Force or, whoever, they'd show up. Sometimes it'd take them an hour to get out there because these places are so remote. And they drive out, and these peace people would wait until they showed up and get arrested. It was the damnedest thing I'd ever seen. At that time, I'd never seen pacifists, religious pacifists, you know, not all of them were religious. Most of them, you know, 99% were religious. But it was the damnedest thing I'd ever seen at that time. I wrote a couple newspaper stories for that. The missile silo, and I don't know, Plowshares? I can't remember the name of them. But Father Carl Cabot, a Catholic priest, a very inspirational guy, funny guy, had a great sense of humor. He did it. He wasn't from here in Kansas. And he ended up getting, oh, my God, 10 years in federal prison, I think. They disappear because they go to prison. That's what happened. The Berrigan brothers, I never met them. But Daniel Ellsberg, who recently passed away, He was inspired by these people too. So it's a very interesting contradiction. These normally very passive people taking this thoughtful action, which ends up with them spending years in prison. Overwhelmingly all of them against nuclear war. So something to think about as we go through the day today. As all the turmoil and tensions erupt between China, the U.S., and Russia, it's a precarious situation for the world. Precarious, all of us who are in our shaky existence at the people on the bottom, as the people on the bottom. Well. We've got the late, this is your lunchtime listening post, and today we have our usual lineup. We have the latest headlines from the United Nations, and if time allows, there's an interview that came out yesterday from the United Nations. It's a short one. We may play that later on in the show. But we've got our latest news and brief headlines from the United Nations, and more world headlines, top world headlines, provided this morning by Amy Goodman at Democracy Now! Take it or leave it. That's what we've got. And the latest stuff, you can listen to our show and you'll know what's going on in the world, or you've heard about it the day before or the week before, because usually these headlines tip you off about trouble spots and potential places of conflict and development, positive sometimes, before you or your neighbors out here in Kansas know about them. So let's see. Maybe Tristan, the man at the switchboard, he can put in a little music for you between takes. Tomorrow, remember, is Law and Disorder Radio on Thursdays and Fridays. Is Free Thought Radio. I think we have a promo for that later in the show. Thursday, Law and Disorder, four top progressive lawyers discuss civil rights and their work against a police state. And Friday, always entertaining, usually a lot of music coming out of Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin, on Fridays with the Freedom from Religion Foundation. All right, so that's my little morning intro. I hope you enjoy your lunch and enjoy hearing the news, the latest news. Tristan, hit it. Let's get on with the news.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Civilians caught up in Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine have been executed, tortured, and held incommunicado with no accountability in sight, the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, said on Tuesday. From February 2022 to May 2023, the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine documented 864 cases of arbitrary detention of civilians by Russia, many of which also amounted to enforced disappearances, and 75 cases of arbitrary detention by Ukrainian security forces, the mission's head, Matilda Bogner, told reporters. Here she is with details on the detention of civilians by the Russian Federation.
Civilians were often detained during so-called filtration in occupied territory for their perceived support of Ukraine their status as former Ukrainian service persons, or their perceived political opinions or affiliations. Many civilian detainees were held incommunicado in unofficial places of detention, often in deplorable conditions. Often no information was disclosed to their families for prolonged periods of time.
Ms. Bogner said that Russian armed forces and law enforcement engaged in widespread torture and ill-treatment of civilian detainees, 77 of whom were found to have been summarily executed. She also expressed concern about potential impunity for perpetrators of international crimes committed in the occupied regions of Ukraine through a new Russian draft law. Humanitarian needs are soaring among people displaced by the fighting in Sudan, with refugee numbers on track to surpass projections and aid access still extremely difficult. That's the message from the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, which reported on Tuesday that over 2.5 million people have been displaced by the conflict since the 15th of April. More than 560,000 people have reached neighboring countries, with Egypt receiving the highest number, followed by Chad, South Sudan, Ethiopia, and the Central African Republic. UNHCR's Assistant High Commissioner for Operations, Rauf Mazou, expressed particular concern about the worsening situation in West Darfur, where the conflict has impeded humanitarian access. Some 170,000 people have already crossed into Chad, which borders the province, and many, including women and children, were now arriving with injuries. The rainy season has thwarted aid workers from reaching those crossing the border and transporting them to refugee camps. In Afghanistan, attacks on civilians using improvised explosive devices or IEDs are on the increase, the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, warned on Tuesday. According to a new report by the Human Rights Service of the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, three-quarters of the 3,774 civilian casualties documented in the country between the 15th of August 2021 and the 30th of May this year were caused by indiscriminate IEDs in populated areas, including places of worship, schools, and markets. Suicide attacks, including by the self-styled Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, Khorasan Province terror group, had significantly increased since the Taliban takeover and have been the leading cause of IED-related civilian harm. The UN mission also documented IED attacks on Shia Muslim places of worship and against the predominantly Shia Muslim Hazara community in schools, crowded streets, and public transport. OHCHR called on Afghanistan's de facto authorities to uphold their obligation to protect the right to life by carrying out independent investigations into the attacks and implementing protection measures. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Supreme Court's rejected a legal theory that would have radically increased the power of state legislatures to reshape how federal elections are conducted and would have made it easier to draw up gerrymandered congressional maps. Writing for the majority in Tuesday's 6-3 ruling, Chief Justice John Roberts rejected the so-called independent state legislature theory promoted by North Carolina Republican lawmakers. The decision comes as the Supreme Court is poised to deliver major rulings on affirmative action and the fate of President Biden's student debt relief. We'll have more on this week's blockbuster cases at the Supreme Court after headlines. In climate news, smoke from unprecedented Canadian wildfires darkened skies over much of the Midwestern United States Tuesday, triggering very unhealthy air quality warnings in Chicago, Detroit, and Milwaukee. Forecasters predict winds will push the smoke further east today, bringing a return of hazardous air to New York and parts of the Northeast. This week, the plume from worsening fires in Quebec and Ontario across the North Atlantic, bringing hazy skies to Spain and Portugal. Meanwhile, there are warnings and advisories for excessive heat in effect again today in several southwestern and southern states. The Electric Reliability Council of Texas reports record power consumption amidst a three-week-old heat wave that sent temperatures as high as 120 degrees Fahrenheit or 49 degrees Celsius. The Texas Tribune reports at least 9 prisoners, including 2 men in their 30s, have died of heart attacks or unknown causes this month in prisons lacking air conditioning. Science communicator Susan Joy Hassel says a collapse of Texas's overstrained electrical grid right now would lead to widespread deaths.
The Texas grid appears to be very vulnerable to a heat event like this because it doesn't have the capacity to bring in power from other places. And this heat dome is really expanding. You know, they say 50 million people are already exposed to dangerous heat by this heat dome.
A Russian missile attack on the eastern Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk has killed at least 9 civilians, including 3 children. Tuesday evening's attack on a crowded pizzeria just after 8 p.m. local time left dozens more injured. This is Valentina, a 64-year-old who witnessed the aftermath of the assault.
I ran here after the explosion. I run a cafe nearby. Everything has been blown up here. There is nothing. No windows, no doors. That's what I see. Destruction everywhere. It is fear, horror in the 21st century. I don't even know how to describe it. My son was killed in the war, and now this.
Belarus's leader says he convinced the head of Russia's Wagner group to call off a mutiny last weekend that saw heavily armed mercenaries advance to within 120 miles of Moscow. President Alexander Lukashenko said during a weekend phone call, Russian President Vladimir Putin promised to wipe out Wagner's forces and was considering killing Wagner chief Yevgeny Prigozhin. Lukashenko said he later relayed Putin's comments to Prigozhin in a separate call.
He says, but we want justice. They want to strangle us. We will march on Moscow. And I say, halfway there, they will squash you like a bug.
U.S. intelligence officials have told New York Times senior Russian General Sergei Sorovkin had advanced knowledge of Prigozhin's plans to rebel against Russia's military leadership. The Times reports the officials are trying to learn if the general helped plan Prigozhin's mutiny. On Tuesday, Russia's embattled defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, whom Prigozhin has assailed for mismanaging Russia's war in Ukraine, appeared publicly as President Putin led a Moscow ceremony honoring Russian soldiers and police for their actions during the mutiny. The Biden administration's imposed new sanctions on companies accused of profiting from the activities of the Wagner Group in Africa. The Treasury Department says the sanctions will punish 4 companies based in Russia, the United Arab Emirates, and the Central African Republic that extract gold, diamonds, and other minerals to help fund the mercenary force. The sanctions were announced after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Monday Wagner mercenaries will not be withdrawn from Africa following last week's mutiny.
Several hundred Russian servicemen are working in the Central African Republic as instructors. This work will, of course, be continued.
In Sierra Leone, President Julius Maada Bio has won re-election following a tense presidential contest over the weekend that was marred by police violence. He narrowly escaped a runoff election, securing over 55% of the vote needed to declare victory. His main opponent, Samora Kamara of the All People's Congress, has rejected official results. He said on social media, quote, "It's a sad day for our beloved country. It's a frontal attack on our fledgling democracy." Thousands of nurses in Texas and Kansas walked off the job Tuesday for a one-day strike to demand better workplace safety. Nurses have denounced chronic understaffing at 3 Ascension hospitals in Wichita and Austin. It was the largest nurses' strike in Texas and Kansas history. This is Natasha Gosek, a neonatal intensive care unit nurse who's worked at Ascension Seton Medical Center in Austin for 14 years.
I know a lot of coworkers and a lot of new nurses, their first thing to do when they get in their car after a 14-hour shift is they just cry and release all of the previous 14 hours so that they can compose themselves to go home to their families and not carry that with them as best as they can. Because they know that they've been called to this profession, they've been driven to this profession to take care of babies, to hear families, and they're not able to do that.
Here in New York, serious misconduct and neglect by guards at a city federal jail are what led to serial pedophile Jeffrey Epstein's death by suicide in 2019. That's according to a years-long investigation by the Justice Department, which released a 120-page report Tuesday accusing officials at the now-shuttered MCC, Metropolitan Correctional Center, of creating an environment that allowed Epstein the opportunity to hang himself. DOJ Inspector General Michael Horowitz detailed the findings Tuesday.
Had Epstein's cell been searched as required, it would have revealed that Epstein had excess prison blankets, linens, and clothing in his cell. MCC New York staff also failed to ensure that the institution's security camera system was fully functional, resulting in limited recorded video evidence. While we determined MCC New York staff engaged in significant misconduct, we didn't uncover evidence contradicting the FBI's determination that there was no criminality in connection with how Epstein died.
At the time of his death, Jeffrey Epstein was awaiting trial for sex trafficking and other charges. In more news from New York, Gothamist reports the city's Department of Correction is planning to purchase over $90,000 worth of high-powered submachine guns for a specially trained emergency security unit working at the troubled Rikers Island jail complex. This comes after New York's Department of Correction earlier this month cut some $17 million in jobs in job training and social programs for prisoners. New York voters headed to the polls Tuesday for an off-year primary election to choose several city council seats and two district attorney races. Longtime progressive Charles Barron failed to keep his New York City Council seat, losing to Chris Banks, who is backed by House Democratic Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. In the most closely watched race, Yusuf Salam, one of the exonerated Central Park Five, was declared the winner in a contested bid for a city council seat in Harlem. Salam defeated Democratic Assemblywoman Inez Dickens, who had received the endorsement of New York Mayor Eric Adams by a landslide. Salam was one of five Black and Latinx teenagers wrongfully convicted of the 1989 beating and rape of a white woman. He spent 7 years in jail. Yusuf Salam has said he will overhaul New York City's criminal legal system, end mass incarceration, and help bring about police reform. To see our 2016 interview with Yusuf Salam, go to democracynow.org. And in Manhattan, public housing tenants rallied on Tuesday to demand the city halt its controversial $1.5 billion plan to demolish two public housing complexes and replace them with new high-rise apartments. Officials say the plan to tear down the Fulton and Chelsea Elliott houses is more cost-effective than repairing the apartments, but tenants argue the demolition will drive further privatization, gentrification, and displacement. Some tenants opposed to the demolition reported they were turned away by city authorities Tuesday as they tried to attend a resident engagement meeting. This is George Weaver, a Fulton tenant since 1993.
We got a mental crisis. We got a homeless crisis. Look at it. It's going to get worse if we tear down public housing. Yep. We're going to have people sleeping in the streets all over. And it's not just happening in New York. It's happening all across America. You see what happened in Chicago in the last mayor's race. That was a proven point. Eric Adams has to listen to us. In the halls of government, it says of the people, by the people, for the people. It doesn't say of the government, of the developer, by the developer, and for the developer.
Democracy Now!'s Sanji Lopez, thank you for that report. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us, freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Military spending is up around the world. Will they protect fossil fuel interests while the world burns? Australia security analyst and climate researcher Dr. Elizabeth Bolton has a very different plan. You should hear this. Canadian medical doctor Peter Carter now heads the Climate Emergency Institute. Carter says the world climate is already tipping into disaster. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. This week, the highest temperature recorded in 2023 struck Iran, going over 50 degrees Celsius, more than 122 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade. Pakistan is suffering extreme heat again, with temperatures as high as 49 degrees C. North India continues to cook. People are suffering there, and the heat struck over central China. That's moved up to the capital, Beijing, setting a new June record there at 41 degrees C. Then there is Mexico. Oh, my. Not reported on American news. People are dying of heat in Mexico, and so are crops that feed Americans too. Few Mexicans have air conditioners, and many must work outside. The country just wasn't ready for this. The heat dome over Texas is famous now. With the Gulf humidity, it feels up to 120 degrees Fahrenheit, almost 49 degrees C, just like Pakistan. The whole American South is roasting, and while that's happening, beastly storms and deadly tornadoes are tormenting the population. For many, the power is out for a while, too. It is a discomfort and a fear in the year of 2023 of climate change. There are realistic plans to stop extinction-level heating on this planet. They could work. Saving conditions for life as we know it demands big changes for all of us. You can hear two expert activist voices in this program.
Radio EcoShock.
While hospitals and schools struggle, humans spend more on the military every year. In 2022, world military spending hit another record high of around $2.2 trillion. But what will all those uniforms and equipment do as the climate changes and new pressures come into society? Will they protect fossil fuel investments? Dr. Elizabeth Bolton was a logistics officer for the Australian Army, including a tour in Iraq. Now she is a climate security researcher. Elizabeth has worked with the Australian Bureau of Meteorology and the National Climate Center. In 2022, the U.S. Marine Corps Press published Bolton's paper called, get ready for this, Plan E, A Grand Strategy for the 21st Century Era of Entangled Security and Hyper-Threats. It is a ground-up rethink of who we are and how humans operate against threats like climate change. From Australia, Elizabeth Bolton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Before we dive right into the deep end, if you were at a party or just a casual experience, how would you introduce your work?
I'm a security theorist who centers the climate and ecological crisis as the primary threat, and then considers how we might apply some military thinking to contain that threat.
Now, most of what we think and do follows established patterns. We have, like, habits running almost on autopilot. Is that getting closer to this fundamental concept that some call the deep frame?
Yes, actually, deep framing, I got that term from George Lakoff, who you probably know, a pretty famous cognitive scientist and linguist. And deep frames refers to these neuron pathways that we develop from birth through our life, through interaction with the external world. And they form our philosophy and our way of seeing the world, as opposed to just immediate knowledge that we might learn in a trade course or a degree or something like that. But it's our fundamental philosophical outlook. And what they find is that influences people's decision-making at a subconscious level, up to 80 to 90% of the time. But we're generally unconscious of it because it's sort of the conceptual space we're swimming in, like a fish swimming in the water. So a whole lot of cognitive research suggested that one of the reasons we're having difficulty coming to terms with the climate and ecological emergency is that we haven't really grasped it at a deep frame level, because it doesn't interact in the normal sort of way that our senses can interpret it.
You base some of your work, or at least you were helped along the way, by ecological philosopher Timothy Morton. And the Wikipedia entry for Tim Morton has this insight. It says, quote, global warming is made apparent through emissions levels, temperature changes, and ocean levels, making it seem as if global warming is a product of scientific models rather than an object that predates its own measurement. Is that capturing some of what you just said?
Yeah, his concept is completely fundamental to my concept of hyperthreat. I just modify it a little bit. He's contesting the idea that we can project, manage, and even understand this phenomena that's occurring, that the way that the climate system interconnects with water cycles, nitrogen cycles, ecological breakdown and so forth. But it's got its own agency, and we can understand glimpses of it through science and personal observation and stories, but we're only ever, and one of his key things that he's saying is that we have to get out of this idea that we can project manage this, that this, the hyper object of global warming will be the major actor of this century, and humans will move to a reactive stance and we'll be on the back foot, and in fact we'll be as insignificant as leaves being blown by the wind on the sidewalk. He has been criticised at some stages for having a bit of a too dark a vision, where the humans have completely powerless. My concept, which may be naive, suggests humans have got a little tiny bit of agency. But yeah, basically he's really trying to tackle the arrogance of the way we see the world at the moment, that we think we can just sort of project manage this problem on the side and get on with life as normal.
If we ran into some alien from outer space and we had no idea really what they were, we're sort of in the same situation with climate change, Morton suggests, and he calls climate change a hyper-object. Would you like to take a couple of minutes and just tell us some of the aspects of what a hyper-object might be?
Yeah, so he has some fairly complicated terms for it. Its simple definition is that it's a thing that is spread across enormous space and time relative to humans. And, you know, it operates across scales of hundreds of thousands of years and so forth. And in that, he's talking about effect of microplastics or, you know, I think there's some plastics that take 500,000 years to break down and things like that. So it's those type of time frames are completely beyond the human sort of understanding of time, which is generally a few generations. But he describes it as having five very specific characteristics. The five characteristics is one is that it's interobjective, which means that we never can see it in its own right, that it operates through other objects. So, for example, the way that the wind blows, you don't actually see the wind. You hear it and you see the leaves moving or the curtains moving, but you don't see wind itself. So, and the same with the drought. You might see the cracked soil, and that may be a sign of global warming, or it may just be a normal type of drought. So that's something that you can't see. The other one is this idea of our viscosity, which is that it's infused through everything. And one of the examples is that he uses is that, for example, if you consider the oxygen in your nose right at the moment, that it's a higher part per million of carbon than it was in the pre-industrial era. Anyway, he goes through all of these characteristics, but basically what they are designed to do is convey the idea that this is something we can't tangibly see and measure, and it is beyond us and beyond all of our normal little systems of how we manage problems with taxes and things like that. But one of the key things he says is that it existentially demotes the human being from being that masters of the planet to suddenly we're just another object with a whole stack of other objects of microbacteria and whales and all sorts of forms of life, and we're just another one of those that will be affected by this dominant hyper-object, which is now the most powerful force, and it will shape the next century.
Wow. Okay. Now, you're offering a new twist or a new idea called the hyper-threat. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, so his concept is just global warming, so I bring all arrays of climate degradation and destruction into it, which includes sort of toxins in food and chemicals and microplastics, salinity and so on. And I'm basically saying if you put them together, the whole thing constitutes, because they're so interconnected, that they constitute a new thing called a hyper threat. And the use of the word threat is very deliberate because while Morton's concept of a hyper-object is just sort of this sort of neutral big thing, like a strange sort of monster we've never really encountered before, but it's sort of off in the ether, in the universe sort of thing. But the word threat is, and this is different from the climate crisis or climate emergency framings, which emphasise urgency, but threat has a greater allusion to violence and killing and destruction and harm, and not... Where the word risk, for example, means that it might happen, but threat means it's likely, you know, it's on the way. It will happen. It's already been, you know, acknowledged that it exists. And with that, I'm also proposing that it's not just a policy problem, and there is a new form of conscious intent to cause harm, because when you interrogate the hyper threat and what's enabling it and what's causing it, it does appear that there are human actors with a consciousness of what they're doing and going ahead anyway. And this is a fairly important delineation as well, because previously in security circles, natural events like, you know, a devastating cyclone or a terrible drought, these were classified as hazards, which mean terrible things that happen, but there's no conscious human hostile intent. Someone's not choosing to harm other people. So they're in the hazard category, and that means that they don't go into a national security threat analysis as you know, very significant. But if we acknowledge that there are new forms and like the hyper threat, they're sort of diffused through our legal systems and economic systems, but nonetheless there are new forms of conscious decisions to cause harm. You know, I think it's pretty clear with what's happened with the fossil fuel industry and the cover-ups and misinformation and the intention to keep exploiting beyond safe limits, that this is there's a consciousness of decision-making there. And the reason that's important to identify is because once we realise that we're actually talking about conscious intent to cause harm and killing, then that provides a much stronger argument for all range of legal mechanisms to rein in the hyper threat actors, which at the moment I assess this is a threat that's essentially off the leash, and its main source of power is its freedom of action. And it's considered legal, it's considered legitimate, and it's, you know, untold amount of killing that considered, oh well, that's just economic progress. That's sort of the difference between the hyper threat concept and other framings like crisis, emergency. And even if I can just add, with the polycrisis frame that's going around at the moment, really being promoted by the WEF, that's sort of this idea that there's multiple concurrent crises. But I was just reading up on it this morning, and on their website they've got all these comments saying things, for example, like, oh, we can't reverse the polycrisis, and that we suggest people get therapy to help cope with the psychological effects, and, you know, the next decade is going to involve polycrisis in multiple crises. But it's quite a clever framing because it takes away any accountability, and it creates a sort of helplessness as though nobody's actually causing it, and the only thing the individual can do is, you know, go and see a therapist. It's very clever how that some of these framings take away accountability for who is causing the problem.
Yes, this is not just a philosophical debate. I mean, you also helped international aid groups overseas. You trained in the Australian Army with a specialty in strategic planning, and you published your paper last year by the U.S. Marine Corps University Press. What is happening with your fundamental rethink towards climate-friendly military planning? Is that an oxymoron?
Well, it's even though it was the Marines who published it, it's probably worth me emphasising that it's actually, as you alluded to at the start, it's a fundamental rethink of how we approach security. So Plan E, in fact, argues for a civilian mobilisation as opposed to militarisation. And because that relates to the exact nature of the threat and the types of skill sets and so forth that are needed to respond to it. So even though it is in a military journal, I am actually arguing for a civilian mobilisation. And the other thing is part of it is that it's a very much a bottom-up design strategy. It's creating a framework for all the sector experts and experts across all sorts of areas. It's like they're given a mission and they're given support to create their solutions. And in fact, a year is dedicated to deliberate planning across all the sectors and all the areas of the economy and community to start designing their response to the hyper response. So that would involve skilling up the civilian population with some of these threat planning tools. And so some of the methods that militaries have used would be adjusted so that they could be used and contribute in the civilian context. In some ways, it's very different from what I noticed, again, what's going on with some of this IPCC and so forth, is this very much a top-down, that the solutions are being sort of presented to the people, and the people themselves aren't having, you know, it's quite a battle to get ideas and concepts heard. But this is a fundamental, the responsibility for security actually returns to local levels and populations. Because, in fact, that's where the hyper threat is increasingly going to strike. And that is also where all the solutions and the human ingenuity lies. It's sort of like a World War II mobilisation where we have to have the whole of society participation. But I've been quite careful to say that the model I've developed is not a military-led initiative. It's a civilian-led initiative. and that the military are in support of. So, for example, the civilian world will launch this huge hyper response force, and that group will need security and support from its military, but the military isn't driving the event or the response.
Right. I'm kind of conflicted about all this because in some ways the military may become dangerous for the future, especially if they arrest the people who are protesting fossil fuels and things like that. But on the other hand, as you say, profits from environmental crime may rise as resources become more rare or restricted. We're facing some instability, some fragility. I'll bet we'll expect that we need police and a repurposed military, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I argue in the paper, and there's another paper coming out in a few months, actually, with the Oxford University book that looks at these things, that our security posture at the moment is completely incoherent because it is being used in such a way that it makes the hyper threat stronger. And also, you know, just to give one very tangible example, that we now understand that the Iraq war was about oil. So essentially, we sent $2 million, killed, you know, roughly around 500,000 people to get oil, which makes, and cement in oil dependency, which makes the hyper threat stronger, you know, exasperates global warming, plus all the, you know, the damage to the environment and so forth and the emissions of that activity. But, and so militaries often get used in this indirect way to support resource extraction industry. It's called systems maintenance, as a term made by Doug Stokes. And it was initially sort of this idea, well, it's the right thing as a military to keep supply chains functioning because that helps the civilian population. But what it means is if that military support is supporting a fossil fuel intensive supply chain, our militaries are now working for our enemy. So now the idea with Plan E is that all of that security apparatus now moves to the hyper response force. And so say, for example, there is, and you know, a lot of the areas of the world are in conflict at the moment. Say, for example, there's somewhere in Sudan where somebody's trying to set up an amazing solar panel array, and that in fact, there's some conflict nearby. The security task would be to protect that solar installation. But more importantly, protect places like the Amazon and critical marine areas and from overfishing and those sort of things. And when it comes to that disaster response, I'm not sure what it's like in America and other countries, but in Australia, we have been using our defence force as that first call for major disasters to help in the clean-up and so forth. But in the most recent Defence Strategic Review, now the defence have said, look, we don't want to do that because it detracts us from our war posture and we're trying to prepare for a possible World War III and we don't have space or time to do another task. And we think it should be a civilian task to, you know, increase civilian capability in that area, firefighting and so on. The way things are at the moment, they're saying they don't want to do it. The security narrative on the side at the moment, the dominant narrative is preparations for a World War III with having militarisation all over the world. And in fact, if you look at this, what is really happening, I think, is preparations for a fight for what's left. And these are forms of resource wars. And so we're really at this point in time where we decide, how are we going to use our security forces and our security strategy? Is it just going to be a fight to the death over what as everything starts unravelling? Or are we going to fundamentally change things and say, let's protect the foundation of security, which is a viable ecological habitat. So my concept is that we have a planetary emergency peace treaty, which is in everybody's interest, and that all that energy, all that money, all that engineering and technical expertise is channeled to one mission, which is let's reduce emissions as much as we possibly can. We obviously can't stop global warming at this stage, but we can reduce the severity.
Let it be so. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Elizabeth Bolton, military analyst and climate researcher. We're trying to understand what climate change is and why we're not really trying to solve it yet. So along those lines, you talk about something called entanglement, and it seems very fundamental. Would you tell us what you mean by that?
Okay, so I've got this term called entangled security, and that at its most basic level, it means that planetary, human, and state security are inherently entangled. So it's the idea that military activity can't really just be quarantined off as something that's over there and it doesn't affect the rest of society. And a very tangible activity example of that is just last week, a whole lot of leaders from Africa went and had a round table in Ukraine and Russia, and they said to Putin, look, this war is really hurting us because of the grain and food security impacts. Increasingly, it's an idea that everybody else's insecurity affects everybody else. So the weaker and harsher that we hurt other people, that affects us, because inherently our existence is that we are all entangled with each other. So it's sort of the idea that if you hurt and damage another part of the entangled web of which we're all part of, it's sort of like shooting yourself in the foot. Another sort of example of way of seeing that is that through sort of multinationals really having some very exploitive practices all through the developing world and leaving those countries in poverty and taking the resources at ridiculous prices and destabilising a lot of those countries, often for the very purpose of getting resources, that the backfire of that is that all those unemployed people who haven't been able to participate normally in the economy in the world have then become a workforce for these burgeoning transnational crime groups who are now the employers of choice. And, you know, the new sort of money is human trafficking, organ trafficking, drugs, and illegal wildlife trade, illegal logging, illegal fishing, and that those activities are ones that harm everybody as the drugs infiltrate through the society and so on. So, and there's this old concept of security that you gain security through being more powerful and stronger than the other. But I'm actually arguing that in this new era, that we gain security by making the other stronger and more secure. There's two ends of the spectrum, is that the old way was to take from the other and make them as weak as possible. And the new way is to care and strengthen for the other, to give strength and so forth. For this Plan E, for example, one of the things is to weaponise employment and to creating this massive hyper-response force and giving people reasonably paid jobs and a dignified living, that we become the job providers of choice, and we extract those people away from some of that really destructive transnational crime activity, and they come and work for the hyper-response force. So, yeah, entanglement, I might just stop there, but it has actually got a whole stack of philosophical dimensions related to quantum physics and so forth, but I can expand on those a bit more if you like, but I might just pause there for a second.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I can see what you're talking about. I mean, we are all interrelated, and I see it, for example, in recent news in the tensions between China and the United States as though a war might be the outcome of that. That would be terrible. I mean, everything that we buy here in North America is made in China, and the Chinese economy depends entirely on sales to North America. So it's like one hand attacking the other hand. It's just not going to work out. I also wonder, though, too, we react heavily to the pandemic, and if we change a lot of things because of the pandemic or because of our fight on climate change, can our reactions also become part of the hyper threat as well if we're not careful?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we're in such, so I read somewhere the other day, they said that, you know, that you purchase an electronic vehicle, but then that has ramifications for where you're getting the rare earth metals. So there's a lot of these bind situations where you're trying to do something, it still creates some harm, but maybe it's marginally better than another type of harm. What that says to me is that an incredible amount of care is required in how we plan our response. And I'm a big fan of deliberate planning for crisis. And what worries me the most is that there is no deliberate, you know, I don't think there's a deliberate plan at the moment for a crisis situation, although a lot of people have declared climate emergencies and, you know, there's some innovations. We're not really on a crisis or emergency footing, and we're not doing any planning for an emergency or crisis footing. So because, and what I, we did do a war game of this earlier in the year, and what that proved to me was that, and even myself looking at Plan E, is that when you start to think, oh, okay, finally let's imagine that we all decide that we're going to really go for it, that when we decide we're going to go for it, that itself is an incredibly complex, difficult problem, and we should, you know, we really need to be doing a lot of careful planning and the feedback loops of what works and information sharing and being setting ourselves up for that learning experience, because it's very, very difficult and it's going to require all sorts of expertise, you know, so we don't make fatal mistakes.
So you call for a complete rearrangement of human operating systems, I think, not just a change in business, but society itself. And you also say to avoid the disaster of hothouse Earth, and this is backed up by the scientists that I interview here on Radio EcoShock, this all has to happen in the next few years, maybe the next 7 or 10 years at the most. Are you a revolutionary?
You could use that word, I guess, but I see myself, I came back from Iraq, I saw the whole thing with weapons of mass destruction was, you know, a lie. I really do have a security ethic in terms of wanting to protect the people and the world, that the beautiful world that we have. And so I actually just see myself as a bona fide a security thinker that wants to protect the population. And when I see a sign from the scientists that says we've got X amount of years, my brain just goes into logistic planning mode and how do we practically enact an emergency. I'll just highlight when you're talking about those timeframes, Plan E is just a planning year. There is some emergency actions, but it's predominantly deliberate planning across society for a year. Then we go into what's called Plan F, which is 4 years fast and furious. So it's 4 years, everyone across the world, just giving it everything we've got to clean up this planet. It's like a tip at the moment in a lot of areas. And that becomes a security mission. And when you think about it, 4 years, you know, it's not that long in terms of compared to World War One or World War Two, but, you know, that's to save our future. And that involves the redirection of, for example, the military-industrial complex, all those great, huge companies like Lockheed Martin and so forth that have a lot of expertise, but that expertise is channeled at the problem. And the finance sector there, it becomes a mission for them to implement degrowth. And one of the ideas is like a wartime situation, you might just have, they might say, look, let's just give everyone a universal basic income for 4 years while we clean up this planet as much as we possibly are. And that allows 4 years for the economic and finance people to come up with a more durable, long-term solution with consultation with people and so forth. But in the short term, we just need something that people can get along with and focus on actually doing an emergency response.
What sort of reaction are you getting? Are you being heard?
No. Yeah, that's this is very interesting. Is that as soon as it was published by the Marines, there's all these climate security think tanks around the world, and they, except for the one at Oxford University, they have all basically completely blocked it. The public are interested, and I did a talk yesterday, and I've been doing various community talks and webinars and podcasts, and I find the community quite receptive to the idea, but I am finding that the officials in climate policy and security policy are not. But having said that large generalisation, I'm also finding that across various sectors, and there are odd individuals who might be in the military or they might be, you know, in the trades area or anything, there are odd individuals who create opportunities for new ideas to be heard. And I think what I'm assessing is that we have this very controlled narrative environment that actually it's just becoming down to individuals of good conscience who create space for new ideas. And you couldn't really say it's this sector or that sector that's helping. But quite amazingly, I think, you know, one of my supervisors on my panel is one of the vice chairs of the IPCC, and he has absolutely turned his back on it. And a number of pretty senior people in climate policy, yeah, that's been a little bit hard to understand.
I think you're a little ahead of your time, and that's not good because we don't have very much time. So that's why I'm really pleased to have you on Radio EcoShock and to have our listeners tune into this. And you've been hearing from Dr. Elizabeth Bolton. You can find links to her work and a few helpful notes about this interview in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Liz, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for stretching our minds.
Thanks so much for giving space.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Extreme heat lingers over half the world's people. India is rocking hot again. China, all of Southeast Asia with records. Even Scotland is abnormally hot with wildfires. The world is developing a fever. The cause is known. The atmosphere is being poisoned with fossil carbon. It is a sickness. And we have a doctor in the house. Our guest, Peter Carter, is the director of the Climate Emergency Institute. He is a relentless climate communicator. From Victoria, British Columbia, Dr. Peter Carter, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for the intro.
You were a medical doctor for decades. Then you became a climate campaigner. How did that come about?
Pretty naturally, as a medical doctor and working in Canada, particularly in areas of forestry and pulp mills. And so I got involved in air pollution long time ago because of the damage that the pulp mills and the fires to some extent were doing to the populations there. So I learned a great deal. Then I was a founding member of CAPE, Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, and I became their sort of point man on federal and provincial consultations on environmental health, which at the time was very big because Canada was rewriting its Environmental Protection Act, writing its first Endangered Species Act. So I learned a lot, sort of the hard way. And then it was just natural, of course, to move into global warming, from air pollution to global warming. And it's very interesting, most people don't think of climate change in terms of pollution, which is a pity because it is the greatest pollution we've ever known, and we do know how to handle pollution, but we're not, of course, handling climate change. The only person, and I've been talking climate change pollution, greenhouse gas pollution for a long time, so I was very gratified when last week Arnie Schwarzenegger made a statement that we're using the wrong terms. We should be talking pollution, not climate change. How about that?
That's really interesting. You know, I've got to be honest here, Peter. A few years ago, I wondered if you were a bit too extreme, maybe an alarmist. And you still say we're in an insane global suicide scenario. But given the apocalyptic scenes that are playing out in the nightly news, it sounds about right. Is there time to sound the alarm?
Oh, there's always time to sound the alarm. The alarm really has never been sounded. And, of course, that is, to my mind, the terrible legacy of the highly successful but malevolent climate change campaign. As a result of that, effective communication, sort of enthusiastic communication, has really not got going pretty well anywhere for climate change. And so we continue to be in a planet and future killing situation. There's no question about that with the science now. One of the things that I've spent most of my time doing now on climate change is monitoring all the climate change indicators, of which there are a lot. And they're monitored by NOAA and NASA, et cetera, you know, on a regular basis. So I keep a track on those, and I post them all every month on one of my websites. It's absolutely shocking. Shocked me to the core, the way things are going. We're at an all-time high on all of our climate change indicators, and they're increasing at an all-time high rate. It is completely, absolutely insane. You know, I co-authored the book in 2018, Unprecedented Crime, Climate Change Denial, and the crime just gets horrendously worse. I don't think we're thinking about our future much. Maybe we're not sort of programmed to do that, but it's a terrible shame that we don't think about our children and grandchildren and all the children in the world. The legacy of the planet that they're going to be left with is absolutely terrible, terrible.
You talk to some people and they tell you how much they love their kids and their grandkids, but they're not really willing to make any life changes that will make their lives less of a hell from climate change. How do you see the massive wildfires in Canada this year?
The penny hasn't dropped that this is a global catastrophe. The fires that are burning right across Canada and right across Canada now, which of course is a vast country, they're actually burning the boreal forest. The boreal forest is our largest forest by far our largest carbon sink. Now, we have two big carbon sinks, or had two big carbon sinks on our planet. One was the Amazon and tropical rainforest. That's not sinking carbon anymore. There's so much damage, mainly human-caused damage, but also environmental, to those rainforests that, whereas they were a massive carbon sink, reducing atmospheric carbon dioxide, even in the face of our increasing emissions. So for quite some time now, the boreal forest, this wonderful, massive forest, goes in the north, or circumpolar forest, all the way around the planet. That is our absolutely vital future survival carbon sink. And these fires, of course, are going to continue burning all through the summer. People talk about some rain and stuff like that, which is good, but every day I look at them, they're just the same, just the same. And the amount of pollution, which I'm also working on, that they're pouring out is incredible, unbelievable. The satellites are picking up CO2, atmospheric CO2 emissions, from these fires. That's a thing that, my knowledge, has never happened before. For the satellites to do that, these fires must be massive and must be intense. And the pollution, which is tracked best by the European Copernicus satellite, the pollution is unprecedented, completely unbelievable. The pollutants that are pouring out. It's a catastrophe for Canada, that's for sure. You know, there was an unprecedented, practically across all of the United States, air quality issue. That's never happened before. So we have, the word, of course, for climate change is unprecedented, obviously. Damaging the boreal forest is something we're not going to get over.
I recently saw a drought map for Europe. Huge parts of France, Germany, and Eastern Europe are in the most extreme state of drought. We could see a lot of fires in Europe and Scandinavia this year. Your thoughts?
Well, on drought, my thoughts are that I follow the drought maps, mainly the NASA GRACE satellites. The last drought map that I published yesterday, all of Western Canada is in the most severe drought, and Quebec is also in fairly severe drought. And then the heat as well matches. So I just want to mention this. These fires are heat and drought driven. They're occurring against the background of severe heat and severe drought. So yeah, Europe is, according to the headlines, bracing for another severe year of heat and drought. Now, for Europe, the future is looking completely ghastly. Europe is heating faster than any other sort of equivalent region in the world. It's heating up extremely fast. And, of course, at the same time, it's now getting these severe, extensive droughts. And I was reading, actually, a drought expert just a couple of days ago, and Europe's actually been in these droughts for decades, this particular drought for decades. I mean, obviously, you know, when the summer comes, everybody hears about it. But there's a drought in Europe that's not going away.
Incredibly, the next climate summit will be headed by a man who runs a national oil and gas company. So the fossil fuel companies are not just a lobby group at climate talks with their voice. Now they are literally running the COP conference. Should we just ignore those talks as corrupt?
I wish we could, but we can't afford to do that. You're absolutely right, of course. In the early days, in the 80s and 90s, as you know, the fossil fuels corporations, with their huge power, decided to persuade the governments and the public that there was nothing to worry about with respect to global warming. And they've been pretty well managing and controlling the issue ever since. Two results of that, the one that you already mentioned, although the people that work in the climate change secretariat, great people, no question, but it's hard on them, particularly that the conferences have been set up to fail. They cannot achieve anything. because governments, big economy governments, big fossil fuel using governments, because of the way that the negotiations are set up. Can you imagine we're negotiating the future of the planet? We're negotiating the future of humanity. It's completely absurd and totally wrong. But they managed to push through a voting system, which is completely insane. You may have heard of it because the media's been pretty good on it, that a vote to pass anything requires the agreement of every single nation. Hence, we never get anything voted on. So we've been at this with the convention, which in 92, I was very encouraged. It was a very good, strong convention. I thought this is going to be really good. You know, we can work with this, and this isn't watered-down, sloppy language. This is a real good convention. But, of course, we've had 30 years, and we have achieved absolutely nothing, nothing, except that we've been watching the greenhouse gas emissions continue to pollute the atmosphere. There's another reason for calling the situation pollution, by the way. Because, of course, air pollution, we've known for decades and decades, air pollution specifically from fossil fuels is now killing 10 million people a year. Now, if that's not a crime, if that's not a manifest terrible evil, then nothing is, and it is. It is. So we are not managing to get anywhere with reducing the emissions from the fossil fuel industry. CO2 last year, again, was at an all-time high. Our governments, you know, incredibly, are supporting the fossil fuel industry. As the planet burns, I was reading a headline yesterday that our leader of Ontario over the past week has heated up, and so we now have more fires in Ontario. So it now really is right across Canada. I saw that he was pushing investments in what is the most horrible industry of all, which is burning biomass for energy. So like I've been saying, we're really on a suicide scenario. It's a global suicide scenario.
Okay, so some listeners are pessimistic about the ability of this civilization to change. They think a collapse of industrial society may be the only chance to avoid extinction-level warming. But if the net breaks down and fuel deliveries stop, there would be a huge cost in human lives. Is collapse an option, or do you think it will happen anyway?
Yeah, you make a good point. We've had some recent examples where, you know, governments have tried to sort of do a better thing. You can't switch our complex economy at the flick of a switch. It has to be progressive and sensibly managed, which of course won't be an easy thing, but it can be done, and it always could be done readily. The change can be readily made as long as it's carefully managed, as I say, but our government's of course completely useless and hopeless. That's simply because we've known for many decades that all of our fossil fuel energy can be totally 100% replaced by clean renewable energy, which then, of course, also stops the millions of people that are being killed by air pollution every day. The only thing that's keeping the, I'm not an economist or businessman, but it's pretty obvious that the only thing that's keeping the fossil fuel industry in business is the vast subsidies that our governments are giving. That is a great evil, that our own governments are using our money to prop up the fossil fuel industry, which is wrecking the planet and destroying the future. So it's always been readily possible to do, as long as governments do it in a proper way. But I don't see that happening. Our governments are doing all the wrong things. It seems that our governments are more interested in sending your soldiers to kill each other than to save the future of the human race.
Well, let me give a personal case study here. My wife and I need a vehicle to bring supplies to our rural home, and those supplies come from a fossil-powered world, and we are a long way from affording an electric car that works for country life. So we feel like hostages. We have to participate in the carbon-burning game to live. Do you have any words for us living these conflicted lives?
Yeah, absolutely. The only solution, the only remedy to global climate change is up to the governments and leaders. It's entirely up to our governments and our corporations, fossil fuel corporations, our big banking corporations. Look, we all have to do what's right. You know, we all have to do the best we can. But if we all do our best, the planet's still going down unless our governments and corporations change. You see, I mentioned the significant effect of government subsidies. Pretty well everything in our world now is done on credit. It's done from money from the banks. And it was quite a shock to me when I learned some years ago that all of these massive fossil fuel extraction projects, you know, fracking, we've got big time fracking in northeastern British Columbia, of course. It's all done on borrowed money. All of this money, which is being invested into destroying our future, it's actually coming from the big banks, and they stay way below the radar. Although there is a group of environmental organizations who do a great job. They're called BankTrack, and they issue a very complete assessment of the amount of money that all of these banks are giving to the fossil fuel industry to keep the fossil fuel industry and the planet burning. So we have to do our best, but we have to appreciate that our best is limited because we work in and are effectively controlled by this particular system, which we call the economy. Now, environmentalists have always realized, worked hard, published countless articles and published countless books on the fact that this is a thoroughly bad economy. It's an economy that doesn't work for most of the people in the world, and it certainly doesn't work for the future because it's an inherently destructive economy. You know, it can be simply explained that the economy has one aim only, and that is to make the maximum amount of monetary profit every second of every day without any other considerations whatsoever. So that's a formula for disaster of civilization and the human race. But we haven't managed, despite all the tremendous work that many, many people have done on this to point out how crazy this is, we haven't managed to change it one bit. In actual fact, of course, it's just been getting worse and worse and worse, particularly with economic globalization, which has now been going for 25 years or more. The power has been forced out of our hands, out of the people's hands, and even out of the government's hands by corporations. If you want to read a good book about that, the book is When Corporations Rule the World by David C. Corton. And he wrote that. It's a great book. He's a super economist. We do have some great economists, but they don't get listened to, and they don't get their formulas put into operation. So we live in a world which is, Corton was right, certainly today is run by the corporations.
Years ago, I interviewed Dr. Peter Ward about his book, The Medea Hypothesis. As a paleoclimatologist, Peter Ward found many cases of species driving themselves into extinction or times when nature just so rearranged the climate that there were mass extinction events. He suggested that, as opposed to James Lovelock, that life looks after itself, that life has a habit of killing itself off and then trying some new species. Do you think humans can still avoid that trap?
I'm trying to remember the name of Peter Ward's book. It was a great, great book.
Under a Green Sky was his first book. What a fantastic book.
He was really good, very, very interesting. Yeah, of course. We are in the sixth extinction now, and the sixth extinction, there's no question about it. You know, we were first advised about that in the late 80s. We now, of course, have the definitive published peer review science, and the top paper, which came out of Stanford, was called the Sixth Extinction, Annihilation of Vertebrate Life. When scientists peer-reviewed are allowed to use the word annihilation, you know it's got to be happening. And it has. I mean, it's so sad and tragic and upsetting. Life is disappearing all around us. I moved from England to the wonderful, attractive country of Canada, and then onto the even more wonderful, attractive province of British Columbia. And, you know, British Columbia was teeming with life, right? Everywhere you went, land, forests, lakes, oceans, just fabulous. But that life has crashed, you know? So I'm lucky I live in a lovely place in Victoria. We rent apartment in one of these fabulous old mansions, and it's got a wonderful big wild area with gary oak trees and big grasses. But, you know, I consider myself lucky if I see one butterfly a day. A week ago, I saw two swallows. You know the famous thing, one swallow doesn't make a spring or summer, whatever it is. Well, nowadays, one or two swallows does, because that's all we see. And, of course, you know, the marine environment here has collapsed terribly. Never got over the huge marine heat wave that went right up and down the west coast there. And so, life seems to have a habit of crashing. Luckily, it also is totally amazing. I mean, if you're going to use the word miraculous, this is where to use it, that life survives and comes back. And it seems it comes back in sort of more glorious forms. Certainly, you know, the Earth and the planet, the Cenozoic age, which we have all lived in, is the richest age with regards to what's called biodiversity and life now. But, of course, that is disappearing at what the scientists think is probably the fastest rate. The biodiversity life has declined.
I follow your tweets, and I find that they're usually accompanied by links to new science that the mainstream misses, and sometimes I miss completely. Just recently, you had one that was, quote, an update of large-scale indicators of the state of the climate system and human influence. And that was peer-reviewed science, just published June 8th, 2023. Do you have tips for our listeners of places they can go to get the real information when the mainstream doesn't cover it?
Yeah, there are two best places. One is Science Daily. They carry, they headline and link and explain, actually, a very, very good way. But they're just excellent. The most important science in all areas, including biodiversity. And, of course, environmentalism in general they do, and population they do, they pretty well do it all. Of course, they're very good on climate change. So I rely on Science Daily very, very much. The other source, which has always been great, is called The New Scientist. That's a science magazine published with the intent so that people in general are able to understand all the important stuff which the science is publishing, and that's a very good source. So we are overwhelmed with the amount of science, and I am literally, that's coming in every day, all the bad news. We're underwhelmed by the scientific community really doing anything or recommending actions on a scientific basis, which we know will temper the situation and maybe give us a chance of a good future survival. So that's where we're lacking. Of course, we have the IPCC. You know, they come out every 5 or so years. And over the years, they have done a better job at making the science, and more and more that they have to assess, of making the science accessible and understanding by the general public. So that's good. But if you go to the IPCC, go to the FAQs, go to the frequently asked questions. They're good, they're easily readable, they're not terribly long for every report. And the other thing that they've started doing in the past 10 or so years is they do something called headline statements, so go there too. You don't have to wade through all of the voluminous, complicated science of climate change that the IPCC records and assesses every year. You go to those two and you'll get what you need.
Peter Carter, tell us about the Climate Emergency Forum broadcast that you're putting out on YouTube.
Yeah. In 2008, when James Hansen for the first time, made a public statement in which he says, yes, We are in a state of planetary emergency. At the time, I mean, I'd been working scientifically on the environmental pollution degradation issues. So I was very, very happy when that happened. I was very unhappy that I noticed that Hansen sort of traveled the world and he got no support whatsoever from his scientific colleagues. You know, I don't know how James Hansen carries on all these years. I mean, he's still in his 80s. But I really felt for him on that, and I thought, what can I do? And I realized, well, you know, I could start an institute, Climate Emergency Institute. So I set that up, and I set it up with writers and contributions from the developing world, from the most vulnerable world, because I realized, as many people realized at the time and still do, that their voice is absolutely not strong enough. You know, my friends and family thought it was a bit of a crazy idea, but it turned out to be very worthwhile. And, yeah, I do spend a lot of time on it. People have asked me for decades, don't you get depressed working on all this stuff, you know? Don't you get anxious? Well, it's really terrible that, of course, our young people, they understand what's going on. They are now suffering from what's called climate change anxiety. But the answer, of course, is to get involved and get active. If you get active on an issue, I don't think it matters how bad it is. Mentally and emotionally, you're going to be okay.
We're going to have to leave it there. From Victoria, Canada, we've been speaking with the director of the Climate Emergency Institute, Dr. Peter Carter. You can find out more at www.climateemergencyinstitute.com and in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for the pertinent questions. I'll follow your show.
That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Every summer, I select the must-hear interviews you may have missed from past years of the show. At times, I collect voices on a theme from a whole bunch of programs and put it together for you. Because Earth systems are destabilized, I think this summer in the Northern Hemisphere could bring never-before-seen climate-driven events. If that happens, I may create new programs to keep you up to date. So stay tuned for more Climate Emergency Radio this summer. My thanks to the volunteers at more than 100 nonprofit radio stations in 4 countries. They get this program out to listeners every week. I'm Alex Smith. As always, thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Love will live in troubled times. Hearts can give when storms come. A human wave can come together. Minds arise as surely as the seas. Divine forms in the minds of many. We believe in the heat. Days flow by to our times of trials. Minds in motion with the beat.
PUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
Seniors for Peace is our slogan, for today anyway.
Seniors for Peace, a celebration of 20 years of peace work. Recorded at the Redwoods Retirement Center in Mill Valley, California. When I joined Seniors for Peace at their second ever rally for peace in Iraq on February 7, 2003. I did not dream that 20 years later they would still be coming out every Friday from 4 to 5 p.m. to the busy intersection near their home. Undaunted even by hostility, they have called for peace in all the subsequent wars since then. Among those who are met in 2003 was a survivor of the firebombing of Dresden and a Red Cross worker in London who saw the young men dead on both sides and still mourned their loss of life. Here's my recording of their second ever rally for peace in February 2003. Way over 100 seniors demand no war on Iraq. I had read about them in the San Francisco paper. The fact that so many of the seniors are quite elderly, even in their 90s, and that many had come in wheelchairs and with walkers astounded the writer. Intrigued by what I read, I went to join their second demonstration. I arrived early in the sun-filled lobby of the Redwood Center. This was the day that a drumming group of elders had arrived to lend support, and they were greeted with great joy. Raleigh Mulvey was handing out poems against the war. He had already tuned up his guitar.
You mean you want me to sing this thing for you?
That would be great.
Oh, I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside and study ever no more. Okay, everyone.
As Raleigh sang, the growing group of seniors drew closer, among them the two women who had organized the demonstrations, Phyllis Hamilton and Nora Boscoff. I got to speak to Phyllis first.
We actually thought maybe 30 people, so we did 30 signs. Well, when almost 100 showed up last week, we were just overwhelmed because we didn't expect that kind of response.
Have you given it some thought why that is?
The people here had lived through several wars, and I think having lived all these years through past very tragic, sad experiences, they have maybe gained a perspective on it that younger people may not have.
What was your war experience?
I was working at the radio station, KTRB, in Modesto, California, when World War II was ongoing. So you can imagine, you're always watching the teletype to see what the news was and what was going on. And I remember when it came across the teletype, war ended that night, what excitement there was in this little town. People were just, so joyous that the war was over. So, as I say, I think in my case, remembering all of that and the tragedy that had gone before and the friends who had lost people just has given me personally a whole different perspective on what's happening now.
I've been doing this since I'm 15 years old.
How many years ago is that?
I'm 84 years old now. And once I went to one of these things and my father said, why are you all dressed up in furs and stuff? I said, well, I'm going out with my friends. He said, well, don't give them your name. Because he knew I was going out to protest on union stuff when they weren't allowing unions, you know.
Where was that?
That was in New York at Orbach's. But it was actually a department store called Orbach's. And we got arrested because we weren't supposed to be there. We were 24 hours in there at age 15. They kept us in jail.
How did they treat you?
Very bad. We were very young and very idealistic, you know. There's another thing that I would like to tell you about, that the president has said that we will use nuclear weapons if necessary. And I want to make a big, big painting about that, no nukes. And so that's my next goal. Because I'm really worried about that. I think the man, something's happened to him. and is not functioning very well, we can start any nuclear war. We have to go.
That was Nora Boscoff being whisked away in her wheelchair. I followed her out the door and caught up with a very dignified-looking gentleman. We walked together to join the demonstration.
What's in your life that makes you come out against the war here?
I was in the British Army in World War II, and I was in the desert campaigns in North Africa and in Italy, and I saw what war can do to civilians as well as military people. I also came to the United States because I admired the United States for its freedom, its lack of overt class distinction, and I came with my family. I became a citizen freely, and I love this country. At the same time, I feel that I'm entitled to speak out against what the administration is doing. What I see here is the erosion of freedoms, a slipping toward a horribly right-wing situation in this country, the database of high school children and such and so forth. I mean, the whole thing is anathema to me. I believe in freedom, but I'm frustrated and saddened by what is happening with this arrogant administration that we have right now.
We are on one of the busiest corners in Mill Valley. The commute traffic is now going home. The people who feel like they want peace or are at least very friendly toward us honk, and we have our drummers out, and we'll be singing protest songs when the drummers get tired. But the drummers seem to have a lot of energy and go on for a long time.
Though they too are between 70 and 90 years old.
Oh yes, maybe 60 to 100 is a better range. Rose, you want to say something on the radio?
Oh, on the radio. I have another idea. Maybe we don't need George Bush anymore. I was going to make a sign that said, in a democracy, a loose cannon doesn't work. Impeach George Bush.
A loose cannon. That's a great slogan for us.
Yeah. What made you think that way?
I've been feeling that way for some time. It is not only the war, it's the attack on the environment and really on the common people of America. I think his time has come and should be gone. I think the real reason is oil, money, and I think he's hoping to get enough money out of that oil that he can pay for the war.
I was sending copies of our last one to my relatives in New York, and my daughter said, I'm really proud of you. I'll be 90 in 2-3 months, so I'm walking, and there are people here who are not well, but they're saying, this is what we're fighting for, and we're on the brink, really, now, and that's sad.
You remember World War II? Yes, I do. Of course I do. I was in Paris in World War II, and I was scared to death. I was only 12 or 13. Who else would like to talk to me?
I don't think anybody would understand me. But we're very
just one sentence.
We're very intense in our feeling. We hope others do what we're doing. Maybe it can get to Mr. Bush.
I came to see what she was up to.
Are you family?
Yes, I'm her son. Yeah.
So what do you think?
I'm very proud of her. I'm very proud of her. And I'm proud of all the people at the Redwoods.
Do you have this in your past as mother and son going out for some issue, or is this your first?
I think we started with demonstrating against nuclear weapons in the 50s. And Vietnam in the 60s, civil rights. I remember being maybe 10 or 11 years old and walking by Woolworth's in downtown Chicago, and the civil rights movement was picketing. And we that was where we were on our way to, and my mother said, "We don't cross picket lines." It was a big moment in my life, something I always remember.
I'm here because I think that we need this peace. I think that the world needs it, and I see no reason to mess it up with any kind of war. Even in families, we don't need war. So.
Have you come out for peace before?
No, never. Never in my life. No.
So this is a big step.
Well, it is. My apartment over there, and I could see them out here. So I thought, well, and I have six children, and all of them said, "Are you out there protesting?" We hope so.
Tell me why you're here.
Well, I'm here because I'm against the war. And I also just finished reading Secrets by Ellsberg, and he talks about all the lies that people in the government, from the president down, tell in order to carry out what they think is best for the people without discussing it with the people. Then they try to give them information which is not legitimate, and I think that's what's coming out about Colin Powell now. He gave information that was old hat, and Bush is so anxious to go to war that he doesn't really care under what pretense he goes to war. And I don't think that young people should be killed for that reason.
My name is Sylvia Siegel. I'm a consumer advocate of some years. This is the best demonstration for anti-war that I've seen. We can't have another war. We have too many gorgeous and intelligent sons, and we have to hang on to them. Make love, not war.
Right on, Sylvia!
I was a CPS in World War II, so conscientious objector, so I've always been for peace.
Even that war, that took some guts to be that way then.
Yeah.
Were you in a camp?
Yes, yes.
Where?
Oh, we surveyed all over the southwest of the United States. I was in a survey group. We weren't released until the 46, the war was over.
What were your reasons? Were they religious or political or both?
Essentially, you know, I believed in Gandhi and Schweitzer and Kurosawa, you know, the Japanese peace activist. So they were the people I tried to emulate.
Did you count?
Well, I counted as well as I could. There's so many people here, you really can't get an accurate count. But a conservative figure that I got was 120. So let's figure by the time 5 o'clock comes around here, and that's another 40 minutes, we ought to have anywhere from 130 to 140, maybe 150 people here on this corner in Mill Valley in our little town, and we're making a statement.
And what do you think is the average age?
Last week, the oldest person here was 95. I think we've got some people that are older than that. You look around you and you can see 10 or 20, maybe as many as 30 people sitting here in their wheelchairs, standing here with their walkers, are trying to get around with their canes, and they're out here in the cold weather here in beautiful downtown Mill Valley, and we don't like what the hell is going on in the country with our leaders in Washington. We don't want a war. The country doesn't want a war. The world doesn't want a war, and we're going to do our very best to try and stop it.
That was Raleigh Mulvey again, his guitar slung over his shoulder. I decided to return to the Redwoods Retirement Center. By now, I was so intrigued by the wit, passion, compassion, and amazing depth of life experience that I hoped to find somebody to engage in a conversation. I got my recording equipment ready on a comfortable sofa and asked the first person who came by to check her mailbox to join me. Here is Kathleen Berge.
My life changed when I was in England
during World War II with the American Red Cross, working with combat flyers. And as I watched the combat flyers, the American boys, fly over Germany, and many of them did not come back. They went down in the channel, and I watched the German planes go down. I thought, this war bit is not what we want. It is killing young men. And then I was in the bombings in England, in the bomb shelters, and watched homes flattened, shops torn apart. And so the whole fiasco of war had no more glamour for me. So after the war, I went into Germany and worked with the newly liberated slave laborers that Hitler had kidnapped from other countries that he occupied. And amongst the slave laborers, I found these orphan children. I was with United Nations, and then I went back with the Quakers and lived in the camps and worked with the children. So I saw what war did, not only to cities, but also to families and to both sides, whether it was England and America or it was Poland, the occupied countries, and even Germany. And then I worked in Korea after the Korean War with North Korean widows that came down to fled during the war, and in Yugoslavia with Hungarian refugees after the Russians took over Hungary. So what really is agonizing right now is we're going to be doing this again. We're going to be going in to terrorize the Iraqi people, all of the countries around Iraq. Middle East is going to be shaken up. And I think that it's such so tragic that the brilliance of brain and the money has gone in to weaponry, diabolical ways of killing, and not in to peace. How can we make harmony and peace in the world? It's a tragic thing. And I think that under this administration, with the hawks in charge, we're going to be making more and more enemies. We're breeding hate. That's what we're really doing. And this whole business now of terrorists in our country and the high alert in our country is such a tragic thing, because it's coming out of our choice to do more violence through war making.
From your brief experience with the United Nations, what are your hopes and expectations for the role of the United Nations now?
Well, I think it's totally tragic. I came back from the wars in just when the United Nations was formed, and I went out to Muir Woods, where the delegation went in the great cathedral grove, and I thought, this is the end of all war. And I think the most tragic thing is that this country particularly has not in any way supported the United Nations. They have not paid their way. They have not supported the United Nations. And I think that's the tragedy, because unless there is a unity of countries coming together, then I think it's hopeless, really. And I think the role should be strengthened. And I think that they do great things with many of their programs. I was privileged to be at the United Nations when Eleanor Roosevelt was there, and she founded the Work for Children. And I worked with them again. They were the umbrella in Yugoslavia when I worked in Yugoslavia, two Quakers, two of us, under the United Nations. But I think that that needs to be strengthened as a really living body. But I think there may be some hope that they might come through in some kind of a way with this whole tragedy that's happening right now before our eyes.
That was Kathleen Berge, a participant in the weekly demonstrations against war in Iraq. When she left, I introduced myself to two women who sat across from me. Sarah Wasink told me her story.
I come from Holland, and we lived through 5 years of war. We were occupied by the Germans. We were bombed for 5 days by the Germans and for 5 years by our allies. And it doesn't matter who it is. Bombing is bombing. Of course, we were not treated so well by the Germans, but we really felt for them that they were totally demolished in the war. Of course, London and great parts of England were too, but what was the use? And I know that Hitler was very dangerous, but it's crazy to compare Saddam Hussein with Hitler. He has none of the power, and we would, if we make war, we would get the whole Arab world and all the Muslims against. I think it's a dreadful thing to think of. I often can't sleep. That you think, what must their families feel? And what must they feel? And once you've been in war, and especially when you have a baby, you feel, and the bombs fall all around you, boy, you feel helpless. We spent the first month of his life every night in the cellar. We had the German U-boat harbor quite near. And so there were the Allied bombs, and then there were the waves and waves of bombs going to Germany, coming over, and you heard that awful sound. We also heard the first, what was it, V2 come over, the first missiles. It was like a diesel truck driving over your head. It was toward the end of the war. It's unbelievable, and I think I cannot believe that any woman would be, if you know how much work it is and how much love it takes to raise a kid, would ever want war, to have him destroyed. Not other people's kids, not your own kids, nobody. And I'm very glad that you will talk about it, because the radio reaches a lot of people.
How old were you when you had to spend time in air raid shelters?
I was 24, nearly 24 when the war started, so and it was 5 years, so I was 28 when it ended, and we had one baby when I was 26, and it was, then you really get scared. We had dug a shelter in the yard with an oak table over it that was supposed to be safe. But then, of course, it rained, and the hole that we had dug filled with water. So we went back to sitting under the stairway. But it's no way to live. And my husband, he worked at the only steel mill Holland had, and he was bombed regularly by the Allies, although they never delivered. They always sabotaged. They never delivered anything to the Germans they could use, but the underground didn't seem to pass it on. So they were often bombed, and then he was in open trenches, and he would come home with dirt in his hair, and he said, if the bombs fall right overhead, you know you're safe, because they'll go forward with the plane. But if they fall behind you, you're really scared. He was also a reserve officer, so he could be picked up at any time. In Belgium and France, they were all put in internment camps. All these 5 years, I never knew in the morning whether I'd see him back. And really, in the night, I didn't either, because then some Dutch people would call, yell through the mail slot in the door, he has to go underground and disappear because the Germans are going to pick him up. They never did, but he had to go in the ground, and there was a curfew, so he could be shot every... He wasn't, luckily, but he became 86, which is pretty good, but it's no way to live. And we were lucky. I mean, our house wasn't bombed, wasn't destroyed. Think of what happened in Germany and in England, and the Allies often missed. The Germans would have something vital next to hospitals. So once they the Allies by accident, bombed in hospital in The Hague. And, you know, the people, the patients were killed, the nurses, the ministers who visited, everyone was killed. And then if you know the families, then you see the devastation. It's a totally unfeminine thing, I think, a war. It's people who never grew up and still want to play in the street corner, cowboys and Indians or whatever. I cannot believe that any woman would be for war.
That was Sarah Wasink, who survived 5 years of bombing in Holland. As I tried to engage the very quiet woman who sat next to her, Sarah told me that she would not talk about her life. Why? Her friend, Sarah said, survived the worst bombing of any European city in World War II. Some say that the death toll in the Allied bombing of Dresden was double that of the city of Hiroshima. When the smoke cleared, the whole center of the city was pulverized, but the large white oil tanks owned by the British-controlled Shell Oil were left intact. The writer Kurt Vonnegut also survived the two-day bombardment. In his novel, Slaughterhouse-Five, he tells the story of a soldier who was shell-shocked. He turned mute from the horror. Almost 60 years after her experience, Sarah's friend turned silent when asked about Dresden. Sarah told me that she is a very good artist. Her paintings are light and bright and full of color. And when she is done, she paints a thick coat of black over them, leaving just a small window of light. You heard a documentary about an extraordinary group of people. I recorded Seniors for Peace at their second ever rally on February 7, 2003, and I'm honoring them now, 20 years later, for the work they have continued and expanded since then. They still come out every Friday from 4 to 5 p.m. to Main Intersection, half a block from their home, the Redwoods Retirement Center in Mill Valley, a few miles north of the Golden Gate Bridge in California. Their website is mvseniorsforpeace.org. That's MV for Mill Valley, mvseniorsforpeace.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.